This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا
وهو العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful.
Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemns the UN Human Rights Council's anti-Iranian resolution, calling it a strategic mistake based on miscalculations. The Russian president warns the West against putting a price cap on his country's oil, saying it could have grave consequences for energy markets. And a new report says the US has seen more than 600 mass shootings for three straight years, with 609 incidents in 2022. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story: Iran's foreign ministry has strongly condemned an anti-Iran resolution adopted by the UN Human Rights Council, dismissing it as totally unacceptable. The ministry said the resolution that calls for an international probe into Iran's handling of the recent riots was a move by a small group of Western countries. It condemned those countries for pushing the Human Rights Council to adopt their will in the form of an anti-Iran resolution. The ministry also expressed regret that the Geneva-based council has once again been exploited to serve the interests of a small group of countries. It said the resolution was a strategic mistake made by Germany and some other Western states on the basis of miscalculations and pressures from special political lobbies and anti-Iran media. The ministry added that such political short-sightedness will ultimately harm the interests of those countries. Human rights activist Firasa Najim joined us earlier. He says the US and its allies are trying to disrupt and disunite Iran by waging a media war on the country.
You know, this is a biased media war against Iran right now at this moment, because the US and its allies and puppets are all following a certain narrative and agenda, and that is to disrupt and disunite and cause major problems inside Iran, because their major issue is with Iran living a sovereign life and having sovereignty and strength and willing to fight the imperialist system in West Asia, and also to support the Palestinians. So they're all right now working in collaboration to try to weaken Iran as much as they can. They have failed miserably over and over again for 40 years, but they're trying you know, their last few cards inside Iran right now. How come they're not rising up in the United Nations, issues such as the Palestinian Holocaust, the Palestinian oppression, the Palestinian occupation, the murdering of a journalist in Palestine? How come they're not speaking about that? Is that not a human rights issue that should be spoken about and dealt with? And shouldn't the ones doing these crimes be accountable? Shouldn't they be spoken about? Why all the silence?
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has targeted anti-Iran terrorist bases in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. IRGC forces used drones and missiles to target the positions of separatist terrorists in the Kurdistan region. The terrorists are largely involved in inciting riots in Iran. Tehran has repeatedly warned Iraqi Kurdish officials to stop the activities of terrorist groups along its borders.
Iran is stepping up its ante against the positions of separatist terrorist groups in Iraq's northern region. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has conducted a new round of drone and missile strikes against strongholds of hostile separatist terror groups in the semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan. According to reports, the IRGC ground force fired drones and missiles against positions of the so-called Kurdistan Freedom Party on the outskirts of Iraq's northern city of Kirkuk. The raids dealt a heavy blow to the separatist terror group. This is not the first time Iran pounds the positions of terror groups there. Since September 24th, the IRGC has frequently launched air raids against the positions of the terrorists who are holed up in Iraqi Kurdistan, seeking to ignite riots and unrest in Iran's western border cities. Iran has highlighted that its forces will continue their operations until threats being posed by the terrorists are eliminated and they are disarmed. Iranian military officials have also warned ordinary Iraqi people to evacuate areas close to the hideouts of separatist terrorists. Earlier, Iranian ambassador to Baghdad, Qasem Alisadegh, said Iran has told officials from Iraq's central government and the Kurdistan regional government that Tehran is serious about its national security after a number of sensitive Iranian military centers had been targeted from the Kurdistan soil. Iran has on countless occasions warned Iraqi Kurdistan's local authorities that it will not tolerate the presence and activity of terrorist groups along its northwestern borders, saying the country will give a decisive response should those areas become a hub of anti-Islamic Republic terrorists.
The IRGC has been carrying out strikes on the positions of the terrorist hideouts in the Kurdistan region since late September. The IRGC says terrorists from northern Iraq have recently entered Iran's border cities. They are reportedly capitalizing on the protests sparked by the death of an Iranian woman who passed out at a police station and died in hospital days later.
Over recent weeks, Iran has witnessed foreign-backed riots in several of its cities. Terrorists have seized the opportunity to instigate unrest and insecurity in the country. Just recently, former U.S. National Security Advisor Bolton admitted that terrorists are being armed with weapons imported from Iraq's Kurdistan region. Bolton also confessed that he had seen images of Kurdish forces trained and armed in Iraq. Over the past weeks, Iranian security officials have seized large caches of weapons provided by foreign spy services at its borders. Riots broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Mahsa Amini. The 22-year-old fainted at the police station in Tehran and was pronounced dead 3 days later in hospital.
Tehran says reaching an agreement regarding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal is high on the agenda. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian stresses that the Islamic Republic is insisting on its red lines, saying that a deal is quite feasible if Tehran's demands are met. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has more.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdollahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdollahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility.
Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The living conditions of Afghan people are worsening day by day. Many are struggling to make ends meet while the Taliban rulers have been stymied in their attempts to repair the economy. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions. But so far, I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months.
We are sitting here in front of this bakery because of poverty and unemployment. We are awaiting people to come here and buy us some loaves of bread. We leave our homes in the morning to look for jobs, but no one hires nowadays. It is becoming very difficult to make ends meet, especially in the wake of the cold season.
World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems. And the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy. But we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
the U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than two decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says Western plans to put price caps on Russian oil could have grave consequences for global energy markets. Putin has stated that such actions are contrary to the principles of market relations. The European Union members have so far failed to reach a consensus over the price level for Russian oil, as the cap is set to take effect on December the 5th. It would ban firms from transporting or providing insurance for Russian oil shipments sold above the fixed price. Following the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, the US and its European allies have imposed unprecedented sanctions on Moscow, especially targeting its energy sector. Russia has said that it would not supply oil to the countries that support the price cap. Lower supplies generally push up oil prices in the market. And the UK is witnessing more strikes over pay disputes amid rising inflation and the cost of living crisis in the country. Over 70,000 postal workers, as well as university staff and teachers, walked out of their jobs in Scotland and England on Thursday. They are demanding better pay and working conditions. The University and College Union, which called for the industrial action, says the three-day strike is the biggest in the history of higher education. In Scotland, unions asked the members to close schools in an unprecedented move after months of negotiations failed to yield a satisfactory pay agreement. They have warned of more strikes and widespread disruption in the run-up to Christmas. In the meantime, nurses are also set to hold their first strike in over 100 years next month, joining a host of other workers taking industrial action over pay since the summer. An NGO tracking gun violence in the United States says the country has witnessed more than 600 mass shootings for the third straight year. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 609 shooting incidents this year so far, in which at least four people other than the assailants were shot. Last year, there were 690 such cases across the U.S., up from 610 in 2020. On an average, there had been around 1.7 mass shootings per day in the country this year. The NGO's database puts the death toll from gun violence in the U.S. at around 40,000 in 2022. More than 18,000 of those deaths were homicide. Turning to Malaysia now, where Anwar Ibrahim has been sworn in as Prime Minister, ending 5 days of unprecedented post-election disarray. Anwar took his oath of office in front of the constitutional monarch, King Al Sultan Abdullah, who appointed the 75-year-old politician after consulting several lawmakers. Anwar's Progressive Coalition and its rival Muslim Alliance, led by former Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin, failed to win a majority in last weekend's elections. Anwar's appointment could lead to a new phase of friction with Muhyiddin, who challenged him to prove his majority in Parliament. The new Prime Minister faces many major challenges, including soaring inflation.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
New estimates suggest that global carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel has hit a record high. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, "Rapid and drastic cuts to global greenhouse gas emissions are necessary to curb warming and prevent the most dire climate scenarios from becoming reality. But a new study released recently by the Global Carbon Project finds no sign of the decrease that is urgently needed, as emissions remain at record levels this year, with fossil fuel giants and governments plowing ahead with new extraction efforts that could push critical climate targets out of reach. Scientists with Global Carbon Project estimate that total CO2 emissions will reach 40.6 billion tons this year, driven by rising pollution from fossil fuels, and will likely continue to rise in 2023 without bold action from policymakers worldwide. If current emission levels persist, there is now a 50% chance that global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius will be exceeded in 9 years. The researchers note, adding, projected emissions from coal and oil are above their 2021 levels, with oil being the largest contributor to total emissions growth. The report finds the 2022 picture among major emitters is mixed. Emissions are projected to fall in China and the EU. An increase in US, India, with 1.7% rise in the rest of the world combined. Professor Pierre of Exeter Global Systems Institute, the lead author of the new study, lamented in a statement that we see yet another rise in global fossil CO2 emissions in 2022 when we need a rapid decline. He said, there are some positive signs pointing to the slowing growth of fossil fuel emissions over the long term, but leaders meeting at COP27 will have to take meaningful action if they are to have any chance of limiting global warming close to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Climate campaigners warn the opportunity is at risk of being squandered as big oil lobbies swarm the conference and gas producers use the event to push their dirty energy source as a transition fuel. Professor Corinne Lockere of University of East Anglia, a co-author of the Global Carbon Project study, said that if governments respond to worsening climate chaos by turbocharging clean energy investments and planting, not cutting trees, global emissions could rapidly start to fall. We are at a turning point and must not allow world events to distract us from the urgent and sustained need to cut our emissions to stabilize the global climate and reduce cascading risks, Lockere warned. Allowing planetary heating to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century would spell disaster for large swathes of the planet, as trends already seen around the world, from increasingly extreme weather events to species extinctions to rapidly melting sea ice, would accelerate, potentially locking in irreversible climate damage. Professor Mark Maslin of University College London told The Guardian that the Global Carbon Project study is deeply depressing. It sends a clear message to the leaders at COP27. The world needs to have significant cuts in global emissions 2023 if we are to have any chance to keep climate change to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Time had an eye on this issue, writing, the world's burning of coal, oil, and natural gas this year is putting 1% more heating, trapping carbon dioxide in the air than last year. Bad news for the fight against climate change, but with an odd twist, according to scientists who track emissions. While global carbon pollution is still increasing, it isn't increasing at as fast a rate as 10 or 15 years ago. But overall, scientists said this is bad news because it is pushing Earth closer to hitting and then passing the globally adopted threshold of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times. In 2022, the world is on track to put 36.6 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide in the air from energy and cement use, the study calculated. That's the weight of the Great Pyramid of Giza in carbon dioxide spewed every 75 minutes. In addition to the United States seeing emissions go up, India had a 6% increase in 2022, while Europe had a 0.8% drop. The rest of the world averaged 1.7% carbon pollution jump. Pollution from coal jumped 1% from last year. For oil, it went up 2%, and for natural gas, it went down 0.2%, the report said. About 40% of the carbon dioxide comes from burning coal, 33% from oil, and 22% from natural gas. Carbon emissions from fossil fuels plunged 5.3% in 2020, but rebounded 5.6% last year, spurred by some countries, and now have completely erased the pandemic drop and are back on a slowly rising trend. The team also looks at overall emissions, including the effects of land use. When land use is factored in, emissions are flat, not rising slightly.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Since 2011, Turkey has been the main destination for people fleeing the war in Syria. According to the latest official statistics, the number of Syrian refugees in Turkey is close to 4 million, while the real number is believed to be higher than that. Turkey has always been the main supporter of insurgents in the cities and towns bordering Syria, as it has been hosting the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces for years, and it has been the main sponsor of what was initially known as the Free Syrian Army that eventually broke into several smaller groups of armed insurgents. However, feelings of hostility to refugees have escalated in Turkey in recent years, with a number of politicians campaigning to impose stricter restrictions on Syrian refugees, which has contributed to an increase in feelings of hatred towards them, as they constitute the largest percentage of refugees in the country. Events escalated to vandalizing and burning Syrian properties and shops after multiple episodes of chants calling for the expulsion of Syrians from the country prior to the start of matches in sports stadiums. The feelings of sympathy and brotherhood that the Turkish community showed towards the refugees in the first years of the war in Syria turned into more hostile ones against them, especially recently after the explosion in the famous Istiklal Street in the city center, which was pinned on allegedly a Syrian woman. The explosion killed six Turks and injured more than 50 civilians, according to official statements of the Turkish government, which in turn announced the responsibility of the Democratic Union Party PYD, an arm of the Kurdistan Workers' Party PKK, for the explosion, both of which are on Ankara's list of terrorism and are active in the regions of northern Syria and Iraq. The bombing came amid complex circumstances in which Turkey is witnessing sharp political polarization with the approaching general elections scheduled for the summer of 2023 and an economic crisis resulting from high inflation rates globally. The issue of the Syrian refugees is at the top of that political division in the country, and the Istiklal bombing came along to make things worse. Residents of Istanbul and other Turkish cities which witness a large Syrian presence have noticed a change in popular mood since the loss of the ruling party in Turkey, the Justice and Development Party, in the municipal elections in 2018. Those areas gradually witnessed an increase in incidents of racism after the emergence of new political figures that practiced clear racism even against refugees who hold the Turkish citizenship. In the meantime, it seems that pinning the bombing that hit one of the most important and famous streets in Istanbul on a Syrian national while blaming the PKK for it will be sufficient justification for Turkey to launch its new illegal military operation in Syria, which most probably will lead to more racism inside Turkey. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Amar Osman. Efforts to raise awareness about the seriousness of hate speech to which Syrians in Turkey are subjected have not limited violent incidents. Some of them held the government and organizations responsible for their insufficient interest in curbing this discourse. The fears of Syrian refugees in Turkey are increasing in light of the growing hate speech against them to the point of threatening their lives, and the country has recorded several murders due to hate and racism. In this context, they call on those who defend them and their right to live away from the dangers of arrest or killing. To discuss this issue with us from Berlin is Kevork Almasyan, founder of Syriana Analysis News Channel on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Telegram. You can also find his reels and shorts on various social media platforms. Thank you very much for being with us, Kevork. Now, given last week's attack in Istanbul's main tourist attraction street, Istiklal Street, which supposedly saw a Syrian woman behind that attack, and even before said attack, aggression and racism against Syrian refugees inside Turkey have been rising. As per your follow-up on that matter, what are the reasons behind such violence against Syrian refugees inside of Turkey?
Thank you very much, Mara, for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure and an honor, and I think it's a very important topic to cover. We need to shed light on this issue because it could have regional and geopolitical repercussions in the coming few weeks and months. First of all, there is a big question mark, and that is the woman who committed this horrendous crime in Istanbul a Syrian citizen? Because according to my observation, from her facial features, and I'm not talking about her skin color, she doesn't look like Syrian to me. I have lived in Syria for over 20 years and I didn't come across such facial features, and even among the Kurdish population there. So in my opinion, the claims that she was Syrian and trained by the PKK, it needs investigation. We cannot really rely on the Turkish, I would say, narrative that this woman has been trained in Syria, she is Syrian, and she came from a PKK site in order to commit a terrorist attack there. Let's be clear, this attack is condemned. There is no explanation for or excuse for blowing up innocent citizens anywhere around the world. However, we have to understand why this is happening right now. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, this narrative of the Turkish official or Turkish officials aims at increasing the level of hatred against the Syrian community in Turkey. And the reason behind it is, since 2011, there was a big investment in the refugees, not only in Turkey, but in the entire region and also in Europe, because they wanted to weaponize the refugees against Syria. And they used the refugee crisis or the refugee card as a bargaining chip with the Syrian side. Mm-hmm. And now they, all the time, they talk about that we may recognize the legitimacy of the Syrian government if we return back the Syrian refugees again. So the Syrian side, of course, has its preconditions for accepting over 2.5-3 million refugees to Syria, because Turkish side is occupying northern Syria, so they have to withdraw from certain areas. They have to also clean Idlib from the radical jihadists, as Turkey promised and signed on agreements. So now,
at the moment, Kevork, they're actually doing the opposite of that, directly the opposite of that. But I mean, resentment is high, but there is also struggle. There is economic struggle inside of Turkey as well. Turkey has enough economic and security problems to deal with. Why use the refugee card in such an election that's coming up next year as a hot topic?
Actually, any government, without exception, when they fail in the domestic affairs, especially on the economic level, they try to export the crisis into the outside of the territories, or for the Turkish case, is into Syria. And the refugees are the weakest, I would say, part of this equation. Therefore, it's very easy to blame the Syrian refugees in Turkey for causing all these troubles, in economic troubles in Turkey. And unfortunately, there is an increased nationalistic, religious, and ethnic and sectarian negative sentiments against the Syrians. And let's remember, this is not new. Even under the Ottoman Empire, they used to call they used to insult the Arab people for just being an Arab. And mm-hmm. now, if you go to Turkey, you will see that there is a state policy through the media and through the organizations and through their presence, political presence underground, to increase this hatred against the Syrians, because they want to kick them out of the country without, I would say, political agreement with the Syrian side and without coordination with the Syrian side. And this is, in my opinion, is impossible, and it will cause more troubles in Turkey, because, in my opinion, they are also considerable part of the Syrian refugees in Turkey, they are pro al-Nusra, pro FSA, etc. And these people could cause also security troubles in Turkey itself. However, since there is elections coming in the next year, and Erdogan is his win is not guaranteed in the next elections, so he is promising his people that he will get rid of at least 1 million Syrian refugees in the coming weeks and months. So this is one of the reasons why the leadership in Turkey is using the refugee card as a bargaining chip, or as using the conflict to export the troubles that they have in Turkey into the Syrian scene. Now, by accusing the PKK or the Kurdish militias in Syria, the Erdogan will have another excuse to invade more territories in Syria, and he will have more acceptance among the Turkish people to go after the Kurdish militias in Syria, because they want to combat, quote-unquote, terrorism in Syria. Mm-hmm. So I see from this point of view that Turkey wants to occupy more territories in Syria and also expel the refugees from their territories, and they use this case particularly to do that.
I don't know how actually viable that option is for Turkey, especially when things are turning around inside Syria towards the government side. But for its own reasons, the Turkish government now is making plans to return at least 1 million Syrian refugees back home to Syria. Is that a bad thing? I mean, if Syria is ready to accept these refugees, then why is most of the anti-government media in Turkey considering it, I mean, anti-Syrian government media, considering it to be an evil plan?
Actually, let's see the political scene in Turkey. There is a consensus among all political parties in Turkey, whether in the government or in the opposition, that they want to return the refugees to Syria. Is this a good thing or not? It's a double-edged sword, as we say in Arabic, because from one hand, Turkey used the refugees as a weapon, weaponized the refugees against Syria. And on the other hand, the Syrian side wants to also take away this bargaining chip from the Turkish hands, right? Because for Syria, yes, they are suffering from economic crisis in Syria, but at the same time, they know that 3 million refugees in Turkey will always be a political pressure card against the Syrian side, because all the parties who are involved in the war in Syria, especially the anti-government side, they say, look, there are millions of refugees outside the country, and they say all of them are against Assad, so or the Syrian government, so the government doesn't have legitimacy. So also the Syrian side has an interest for receiving these refugees. However, through coordination, through political deals with the Turkish side, and I think if Turkey wants to now invade northern Syria again, some of the parts that they don't occupy, and return the refugees, now will come the role of Russia to mediate between the Syrian side and the Turkish side to say, look, you can return the refugees, but you have to coordinate with the Syrian side. You have to deal with the Syrian side. You should withdraw your forces, and in exchange, you can send the refugees back, and the Syrian side will receive them and allow them to live in dignity. And let's remember, President of Syria, Bashar Assad, he issued a presidential pardon only a few months ago for crimes related to terrorism, exception for people who killed someone or murdered someone. Mm-hmm. And this is a signal to the Syrian, message to the Syrian refugees in Turkey that they can come back to Syria, even if they were involved in funding terrorism or being part of the revolutionary so-called committees, and they're working in media, et cetera, and they were supporting the terrorists in Syria. So this is a message to the refugees, this is a message to Turkey that the Syrian side is ready for a compromise, but this should be on the terms of the Syrian side and not Turkey invading these territories, creating the so-called safe zones, and returning the refugees against their will to Syria. There is a sovereign nation in Syria, and there is a sovereign government in Syria, and they have to deal with that. And I think
that is done the way that Turkey wants it, again, I think it is also against international law itself, the law that protects refugees of war. I want to thank you very much, Gevorg Almasan. It's never enough time when we have this kind of one-on-one interview with you, but thank you very much, founder of Syriana Analysis News Channel on all of social media, for being with us and for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we want to talk about what really is happening inside of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The people of Iranian Khuzestan, in a majestic scene, mourn the martyrs of the terrorist attack in the city of Izeh, southwestern Iran. The people of Khuzestan, from all cities and nationalities, came to the city of Izeh to mourn the martyrs of the terrorist attack that targeted Iranian civilians last week. Now, the mourners condemned the terrorist attack, renewing allegiance to the Islamic Republic and Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The mourners also called on the authorities to impose the most severe penalties on the perpetrators of the terrorist attack, which claimed the lives of seniors, youth, and even young children. Western-backed terrorism inside of Iran in this following report.
We all have been following the insane Western media frenzy against Iran over the past month. But what exactly is going on inside the Islamic Republic of Iran? According to security data shared by the Iranian authorities, during the recent riots that affected some Iranian cities, 40 Western countries were found to have been responsible for the funding, training, and arming of rioters in an attempt to stimulate the scenario of Syria inside Iran. Those 40 countries, on top of whom are the United States of America, Britain, Israel, and Germany, are preparing a terrible scenario to destabilize Iran, dismantle its regime, and overthrow the Islamic Republic. But little do they understand the ideology of the Iranian population. Despite the continuous falsified news propagated by 260 different media channels funded by the West, some Persian Gulf Arab states, and the Zionist lobby against the Islamic Republic of Iran, the holy city of Mashhad, the city of Izeh, and the city of Sahne all witnessed last week solemn funerals for the martyrs who fell as a result of the terrorist attacks that took place in the city. The cities witnessed large crowds. Bodies of the martyrs were spread to their final resting place as the people vowed to avenge their fallen by standing against the U.S.-instigated regime change attempts. Iran reserves its right to pursue these terrorist operations legally and judicially, to hold the perpetrators and the governments that support them accountable as per what the international law states. It is only fair that Iran does everything in its power to protect the rights of the Iranian people. Such sovereign notions seem to be so far unclear enough for the Biden administration and its allies. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian accused the usual perp in West Asia, Israel, along with the Western intelligence agencies, of planning to divide Iran and ignite a civil war in it, stressing that the Iranians will not be deceived by such plans. Meanwhile, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, affirmed the failure of those behind the recent riots to drag people into the streets, stressing that these actions will undoubtedly end and that the Iranian people will continue to advance with more determination and persistence. Iran's enemies have harnessed all their energies, including their media, in order to harm national unity and weaken the will of Iranian people to defend the country's frontiers. But they suffered defeat once again in front of the vigilance and foresight of the cohesive Iranian people. American neocons planned behind the scenes the unrest and the riots to try and strip the Iranian nationals of their national identity and true culture, and thus turn them into a tool in the service of their hateful goals. Yet once again, the Iranian people with all their ethnicities and sects were able to thwart this scheme.
To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Professor Sayyid Mohammad Mirandi, academic at Tehran University and political analyst. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor, as always. Now, several terrorist attacks have hit the Iranian cities of Izeh, Isfahan, and Mashhad. The obvious international silence of foreign perpetrators and promoters of violence inside Iran carries no message other than promoting terrorism in the world. Yet they preach human rights by cutting their hair in the West and in alleged support for a young woman who tragically passed away due to prior health conditions in Iran. Now, can you explain this moral contradiction?
I think it's very obvious. The very same countries that have supported the coup in Iran in 1953 and who imposed the Shah on the Iranian people and during the revolution supported the Shah when he was gunning down people on the streets with the army, the same people who supported Saddam Hussein during the war, gave him chemical weapons, and sanctioned women and children in Iran for years now, these are the people who are talking about human rights. So I think it's clear for all of us that when Western countries, Western regimes speak of human rights, they're just being hypocritical and they are basically trying to cover up their own crimes, whether it's in Yemen or in Syria or Vietnam or Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba. It doesn't matter whether it's Libya or South Africa, again, it doesn't matter. Those countries that violate human rights more than any other are Western governments, Western regimes. And those countries who pretend that they are morally superior than all others are the very same Western countries and those regimes that rule over those countries.
Well, Professor, the head of the intelligence of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in the city of Sahna in Kermanshah province, Colonel Nadal Bayrami, was martyred at the hands of rioters as well last week.
This comes after two members of the Iranian mobilization forces and two other members of the border guard forces were also killed in two separate attacks in Iran. Now, a week prior to Mr. Bayrami's martyrdom, such high-profile targets cannot be simply led by rioters. It has to be intel work. Can Iran face such advanced level of terrorism?
He wasn't a high-ranking official. He was in charge of intelligence for a very small city. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they have been able to make any serious inroads with regards to assassinating or targeting high-ranking officials. So far there's been no sign of that. What they are trying to do is they're trying to create fear among ordinary Iranians. And they're very brutal. The way in which they murder people is not just by shooting them. They beat them to death. They burn people alive. They slit people by the throat.
Basically, so far, Daesh style.
Yes, they behave very much like Daesh, actually, even though they are supposedly secular. But their behavior is very much like Daesh. Mm-hmm. They're very brutal, very cruel, very barbaric. And they've murdered police officers, they've murdered Basij volunteers, and Western Persian language media eggs them on. They even, in their reports, legitimize murder. They legitimize burning people alive. They legitimize stabbing police officers. This is what Persian language media based in London does. Yet no one in the West will stop them. No one will complain about it. No human rights organization will say a word about it. And of course, Ofcom in London will not take a stand. If the things that BBC Persian and the Saudi TV channel Iran International or Manoto and the other media outlets that are in the West, mostly in London, the big ones, but there are literally hundreds of TV channels and media channels in Iran funded by Western regimes and Saudi Arabia. If they were in English and they were directed at an English audience or an English-speaking audience, those TV channels would be shut down immediately and these people would be taken to court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, definitely. I mean, Press TV is just trying to tell the truth and they still put sanctions on us and they try to silence us. So go figure what would happen if there were 216 of us, the same number that they have against the native Iranians. But Professor Mirendi, in like 2 minutes, we heard Iranian Foreign Minister Mr. Hossein Amir Abdullahian accusing Israel and Western intelligence services of planning to divide Iran and to ignite a sectarian civil war inside of Iran, stressing that the Iranians will not be deceived by such plans. Does that mean that Iran will not stop at only eradicating terrorism internally? Will it go after maybe also foreign enablers too?
Iran is already doing that. The terrorist organizations that are being funded by the United States, the United Arab Emirates, NATO, regimes and the Israelis, they're based in northern Iraq. And they have many bases there, and they are very well equipped. So the Iranians are targeting them because they're sending weapons into the country, they're sending terrorists into the country in order to carry out sabotage. There's no doubt that these riots have failed, and Iran is very stable, and nothing is going to happen. But what Iran will do is that it will punish these countries. Those countries that have been involved, that are closer to home, they will feel Iran's wrath more quickly. But all of them will ultimately pay a price. Mm-hmm. Iran is very patient, but Iran will ultimately punish these countries, these regimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, in less than 30 minutes, could you give us just an eye of what's going on in the streets? I mean, the lies that we hear on the media brings thought and images of, for example, Dar'a in Syria happening right now in the streets of Tehran. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Iran is not Syria. The Islamic Republic of Iran is extremely powerful. It has a very high degree of popular legitimacy. We saw that 3 years ago when General Soleimani was martyred by the U.S. regime. We saw the millions of people in Tehran and millions of others in other cities participating in his funeral, and in Iraq as well. These are the same people. The United States is trying. This is their last attempt because they have so much difficulties, so many difficulties to deal with Russia, with China, and with their own internal difficulties. I don't think in future they're going to be able to mobilize resources like they have been against Iran over the past few years. I think this was their last mm-hmm. big attempt to bring about change in Iran. And from the very beginning, it was clear that it would fail utterly.
Well, let them just wait till the third day of the new year, and they'll see what the Iranian people have to say about that when they commemorate the third anniversary of the martyrdom of Hajj Qasem Soleimani. I want to thank you very much, Professor Sayed Mohammed Marandi, academic at Tehran University and political analyst, for joining us to tell us what's actually going on inside of Iran. Thank you for following us. Thank you for believing in our reports, because we do tell the truth, because we have nothing to lose. We tell you the truth because the West lies. The West propagates fake news, and you get the truth right here. See you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
In the limelight.
A new report shows an increase in U.S. total household debt in the third quarter of 2022, increasing by $351 billion to $16.51 trillion. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the U.S. total household debt jumped by $351 billion in the third quarter, mostly due to mortgages and credit card usage, the regulators in the U.S. report. U.S. household debt jumped during the third quarter at its fastest pace in 15 years due to increases in credit card usage and mortgages balances. A Federal Reserve report revealed this issue recently. According to the Fed, total debt in the U.S. hit a record $16.5 trillion.